graduated after. So
but he didn't pick them when he graduated. Silicon Valley. I said just moved to San Francisco. And I think he moved back to where he's trying to do it.
All right, we'll wish him well.
Interesting.
Very good. I got it. All right, good. So, Erev Tov, good evening to all. I wanted to mention again that though we got into page 100 of the last chapter of Tzachim, it starts on page 99, and it's worth our just summarizing to hear kind of where we were and where we went and the why, and then to return back for a minute to one of the central issues of the first Mishnah before we push on, to again have in contrast Pesach.
Edition or a different edition?
You need the third volume.
Third volume, okay.
There are three different volumes of art
school. Do you have it?
I have no idea.
Thank you.
New to me.
Yeah. Okay, so what I wanted to mention in that sense is that the first Mishnah in the Perek, in the chapter, made mention of the fact on page 99 that you weren't going to eat when it was going to be close to Mincha, and we talked about eating, and that got us talking about not only Pesach, but Pesach has a yontif, and therefore what do you do in terms of yontif and Shabbat in terms of eating close to Mincha time, and whether or not you can eat close to Mincha, from Mincha forward, during twilight hours, what have you. So already at the beginning of the discussion concerning the Mishnah, even though the Mishnah was particularly about Pesach, we expanded our discussion to be dealing with central days on the Jewish calendar, that is a day of Yontif and Shabbat. And thusly, what I suggested about that is that we have a Masechta here, we have a tractate that is interested not only in Passover, qua Passover, but we have a Masechta that's interested in the important days on the Jewish calendar that are your holidays and that are your essential days that you want to get done correctly, that you want to do right, that you want to have both the philosophical underpinnings down, you want to have the thoughtful kind of way to reflect upon these special days in the calendar. You want to understand the ta'amei ha-mitzvot, the sense of why we do one individual ritual mitzvah or one individual mitzvah, the way we do it and why we do it. And it also is not just about the ritual itself and the philosophical nature, it's about the tying together of the whole Jewish year in a certain way, in that sense. And so you can go between a discussion of what's happening at the Passover Seder and what's happening for in any given week Shabbat and be very fluid about that, because you're talking about some of the same rituals and or some of the same kind of vessels or materials or food items that you're going to be using in other cases. And if it means one thing over here, does it necessarily have to mean another thing over there? If I do it like this over here, do I do it like that over there? And again, on a larger kind of scale, whether or not I can derive any meaning between contrasting a practice that I have during one holiday or for one specific yontif of the year or on Shabbat versus another one, I think the Gemara is inviting us to make those kinds of comparisons and connections and commentaries, and that's part of the nature of what we're exploring in this last chapter of the Talmud. And that gets us from sometimes what people might call the minutiae of ritual and disagreements about it and agreements about it and shitot, in other words, systematic approaches So the overarching questions that come, if we were to think about them in more either narrative kind of ways, comparing and contrasting differences, and understanding which days of the year we're really talking about and why things are unfolding the way they are for each of the given kinds of holidays. This is a very important, I think, background to the chapter. The first Mishnah, which I said we're going to look at in terms of revisiting it today, again, gives us a sense, a ta'am, that word means taste in Hebrew, but it also means the reason for. Okay, ta'am, ta'amei ha-mitzvot. There are books written about ta'amei ha-mitzvot, the way a mitzvah tastes. Well, what it means, the reason behind a mitzvah, the whys, the wherefores. And immediately after the whole notion of that which can be applied to all yontas and even Shabbat, vis-a-vis the eating before mincha or at mincha time, hala, forward, there is in the Mishnah the mention of the four cups, the arba kosot, and the fact that we do not want anyone in our midst to go without them. Or at least that's what we read, and that's how we understood it. And we saw in the Rashbam, which is the commentary on the inside gutter, along with any Rashi we have on the chapter, we saw that the four cups, based in Bereishit Rabbah, which is a Midrash, brought down by the Rashbam, I'm on about the sixth wide line if you're in the Rashbam with me, the Rosh Yeteva B'Bereishit Rabbah begins the small line, I'm on Sadi Tet Bet, I'm on 99B, and to be precise, I'm on the seventh wide line of the Rashbam, which is the inside gutter commentary. For Bereishit Rabbah, in the Midrash Bereishit Rabbah, Rav Huna b'shem Rabbi Abba Amar, Rav Huna says in the name of Rabbi Abba, Keneged arba'a l'shonei ge'ula ha'amurin begalut Mitzrayim. Musical accompaniment from a musical soul over there. Okay, so we have these four languages of redemption that explain why we do the four cups. V'hotzeiti, v'ga'alti, I took you out, I redeemed you, v'lakachti, I took you, v'hitzalti, and I saved you. Okay? Immediately, what are the four cups representative of? These four notes of redemption. Now, by the way, the Yerushalmi will introduce some other reasoning why you have four cups. And in the Steinsaltz Talmud, just I'll read it to you quickly, we're not going to go inside over there, but the Meiri explains that each expression is referring to a different stage of the redemption. Kind of puts it in stage format. The phrase, it's still redemption. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians is referring to the redemption from actual physical slave labor. I will deliver you from their bondage speaks of the release of the Jewish people from the subjugation of a foreign power. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm alludes to how God will strike the enemies of the Jewish people and free them until they are even more powerful than their erstwhile masters. And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be you to you a God. Your God teaches that God will take the Jews as his chosen people. That's the Meiri, 14th century Ashkenaz. The Jerusalem Talmud, other reasons are cited. One suggestion is that they correspond to the four times a cup is mentioned with regard to Pharaoh's dream and Joseph's interpretation. That's a nice vort for a Seder night. You know, what are the four cups about? And everybody will tell you that it's for the four different redemption, and you can say, ah, Meiri has something to add to that. But let me now add a dimension of what the Jerusalem Talmud says. Where do we have four cups mentioned? Four cups of Pharaoh in terms of the dreams and Joseph's interpretation. These cups also parallel the four cups of destruction stated with regard to the nations of the world. Furthermore, the four cups allude to the four cups of comfort written concerning Israel. O Lord, the portion of my inheritance and of my cup, Psalm 16:5, my cup runs over, Psalm 23, I will raise the cup of salvation, Psalm 116. The latter verse employs the plural salvations, indicating that it's two cups. So there you go. So, nice piece here. I can make a copy of this page of... I wanted to make a copy of this, but...
Indication that there is no mention of solid four cups specifically?
Well, there's Arba Kosot. There's no mention...
Rabbi Yudanasi didn't write why...
No, that's Bereshit Rabbah. That's why the Rashbam brought you Bereshit Rabbah on this page. The Haggadah makes
it
explicit.
The Haggadah is a later story.
But the Haggadah... Well, again, Daniel Goldschmidt will tell us whether or not the Haggadah is around and absolutely extant or not. Last week, if you noticed, if you listened... And you know, I kind of made the remark, and I'm going to hold by it, that not everybody has the Haggadah at their table like it might have been memorized by a certain number of Tanaim of the Mishnah who might have had the oral instructions memorized, and those instructions kind of sound like a Haggadah. And they might have memorized a portion of Midrash, and they might have had it as a functioning set of texts that were performed on this Seder night, right? But the Mishnah itself, later on, we're going to see, will give us a way of not having this, quote-unquote, stick to the script. The Mishnah is, in this sense, alive and... in the mode of creating the Seder experience for participants at what is a banquet to celebrate the Pesach. In that banquet, in that Seder, one must make sure to have these Arba Kosot. And what I want to go back to for a minute, because we've said that one of the nice features of the Perek, of the chapter, is to immediately realize at the beginning and the outset of creating this Seder experience, we're talking about being inclusive. We have the ethic of being inclusive of even those who can't afford it. Because there's afilu mina tamchui, even from the charity platter, if you will, the fund that was not available for folks. We should make sure people had four cups. I just want to show you a little bit of a dialogue in the Tosafot that's really indicative of the fact that, yes, it was built into the Mishnah, and how might we think otherwise if we get into ritual minutia? But how does the value itself continue to be the value that we want to inculcate, the value of making sure everyone, each person, him or herself, has the four cups in front of him or her? And so that was a value piece that I wanted to put out there. And I want to also remember that we're going to contrast that to other moments in ritual life throughout the year that where we may not exactly need that. But that doesn't mean we don't really hold it as a central value, that we make sure that everyone indeed has four cups, has what they need to celebrate the ta'am, the reason behind a given either holiday or Shabbat experience. But meanwhile, about this particular Mishnah and this particular rule, that everybody has to have the four cups, I want to look at the Tosafot. And I made you a copy of the Tosafot here that I want to look at together. It's a Tosafot on the bottom of page Sadi Tet Bet. Okay, so if you're on the page with me, you know, you can find it on 99B1 or 99B2 in chapter 10 or 99B3 in chapter 10, depending on whichever one you want to go on. But it is in the wide lines of the Tosafot, which are the commentaries in the outside gutter, not the far, far outside little what we call kalim over here, but in the Hebrew, it's where you see the bigger, larger words and the blocks of commentary to the right, if you're looking at the page of the Talmud text. And if you follow it down, it's kind of like you go you start in the middle of the page, you go down, it gets a little wider, and then it gets wide and covers the bottom, the Tosfot, and it's the 1, 2, 3, 4th wide line that starts with Lamed Aleph, Lo. Lo yifchetu lo me'arba kosot. He shouldn't provide any less than 4 cups. And remember, the Mishnah says particularly, Lo yifchetu lo me'arba kosot shel yayin. Afilu minatam chui. It shouldn't be any less for him than 4 cups of wine, even if it needs to come from the charity platter. So the Tosafot, they're going to say something interesting, and they're going to say, oh, maybe you thought it just meant the lo in that phrase, the lamed vav, just means the head of the household.
Is to him? Lo is to him, not no.
Yeah, right. Lamed vav in the phrase in the Mishnah. So maybe you thought just meant the head of the household. And you could have thought that because I have some Jewish law that allows for one person to do something and motzi acherim, and to fulfill the obligation for other people. Right? When do we have that in everyday average ritual life in Judaism? When do we have the basic premise that somebody does something and ultimately, on behalf of others. Yeah, I mean, for davening. I mean, everybody has an individual obligation for davening, so it's not exactly the same, but we do have certain of the prayers that are said by the Shliach Tzibur. Right? And if you don't pray the Amidah yourself, but somebody does pray it at the Bima, you can count on that person if you say Amen in the repetition. So you don't have to say all the words.
Can we do it?
Right. So Debbie's bringing up with the morning blessings, you have that. Here's a funky thing. If I don't go to sleep all night, I'm really not supposed to say certain of the morning blessings.
Okay.
Somebody else has to come in who's had a little sleep and says the morning blessings quickly. If that person's not going to continue davening the rest of the tefillot, then it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to mean the person who says the morning blessings doesn't have to keep going and be the Shliach Tzibur.
Like you have insomnia.
Could be. Or you stayed up all night at Tikkun Leil Shavuot. So they'll find somebody in several minyanim who, hey, that guy slept 20 minutes. Let him say it. Okay. So anyway, let's go into the inside here. Mitoch halashon mashma kitzat she'ein notnin livnav livnei veto ki'im la'atzmo. So says, did I give you the wrong one on the English?
It's
on the bottom.
Okay, yeah, okay, on the bottom. Right? No.
No, it's different.
Oh, I gave you the first one. I gave you the first little one. I'm sorry. It's not the one that I wanted. All right. So this English page that I gave you, I'm sorry, it's not the correct Lo Yifatu. There are two Lo Yifatu, and I pulled it off quickly, and I saw Lo Yifchetu. I apologize. I'll translate what the parts we need from what I'm reading. Just, you can listen in, or follow along. All right, so it seems from the language of this phrase in the Mishnah that doesn't sound like he needs to give it to his children or the people of the household. It just sounds like he needs to have 4 cups himself. So that if he's running the Seder, he's got the 4 cups. V'hu motzi et kulam b'shelo. And he is going to fulfill everybody's obligation to have the 4 cups by drinking from the 4 cups. Now, I think on the basic kind of meta level of ritual and participation, that this is a really fascinating issue. When do I actually have to participate in anything? And when am I kind of ask to make the bridge, because it's not just this guy who's doing it that has to have the right intentionality. It's me, when am I asked to say, please be my shaliach, please be my agent, please be the one to actually help me fulfill this by you doing it. Right? We know sometimes in life that we want to have that agency, that appointment of such agency. We also know sometimes in life that we'd rather do it ourselves. So immediate reactions. You want to have the four cups in front of you yourself? Or do you want to have somebody else drink your four cups for you at Pesach Seder? What do you think? Immediate gut reaction. It depends who's the driver. I knew I was going to get somebody to relate.
Someone, do you like drinking wine or grape juice?
Ah, good.
You hate stuff.
Maybe if you don't drink, you want to rely on somebody else to do it. That's first. Some people are, by the way, allergic to wine. In the permissive place of what's being discussed here, we see that, and we can hold, that where it's necessary, perhaps, somebody could motzi acherim with arba koso. If I had to decide. By the way, it's not going to end there. You can see where this is going by my saying that if we're going to hold true to value of hearing that we really want to make sure the Mishnah is read in this kind of values orientation of making sure everybody's got their four cups. But to hear, it's offering a potential interpretation that one could motzi acherim, leave others of their obligation, by doing the obligation.
It comes at four different points in the Seder. It's not all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And people wake up to it and participate. It's really good the way it works. I think that
right.
People would turn off. So I tend to like participation.
Right. We also want that night to be full of participation. And the Mishnayot that we'll look at in the future will indeed create that sense that we've got to get people participating.
What if there's not enough?
So that's a big question here, right? Maybe it is a matter of the economics of the whole situation.
Mm. But it doesn't say you have to do kos mele, and here you could do what...
So far we haven't heard that, but of course
there are
measurements that we want to accomplish, but when it says arba koso, you want it to have halachically sound cups,
right?
Whether it's for him or whether it's for
everyone. You don't want the
everyone.
Bathroom cups.
Well, see, the Tosfot explained to you, Ustvara, and this way of thinking, Hu d'may shane arba kosot mikidush techol hashana, she'echad motziyat kula. This comes from this way of thinking, that during the year, I can have someone say Kiddush, and exempt other people from needing to drink their cup. Someone can be the agent in this regard.
Really?
By that other person. Right. So this little taste we have in a shot glass, in the plastic shot glasses of Kiddush, that's not really Kiddush. That's participating in a little bit of a communal way. But if you didn't have that little shot of grape juice, you could say still that you've done your obligation of hearing Kiddush for Shabbat day.
But if you make a motzi, you have to...
It's a whole separate issue.
Don't you have to have it?
It's a whole separate issue. Motzi is a motzi aside.
Or a blessing over wine. Don't you have to drink the wine if you have the blessing?
So if I say a borei pri hagafen myself, which is a different issue than say I have the mitzvah of hearing Kiddush. But yes, if I have... a bracha, if I make a bracha, and I don't want it to be a bracha levatala, meaning a bracha that is for no good reason, or a bracha that comes to to take God's name in vain, then I'm transgressing something I should drink. But I'm talking about the obligation of Kiddush. Others can motzioti. Others can fulfill the obligation that I have by pronouncing it and my listening to it.
Just listening, not saying amen.
That's an interesting machlokit. we're in the small question pieces. One should say amen. But if one forgot to say amen, because let's say you love the noy shel kolo, you love the beauty of his voice, You could still say, I heard Kiddush.
But you don't have to drink because you said Amen.
Right. So the person who makes Kiddush has to drink. Except, what do I do when I have a cup filled up in shul and I'm going to make Kiddush? We're going to get into the notion of Kiddush in the shul a little later when we turn back to where we are. But for right now, I could have thought, because of the way Jewish law works, that four cups meant only for the head of the household. Head of the household does the four cups. Nobody else has to have their own. And then it goes on. Umihu, and however, or and nonetheless, gam bekidush shema haya l'chol echad koz kedemashma l'kaman. Gabe chazi lahahu sava de gachin ushteya val beperikol me arvin gabe zman mashma kitsat shelo haya l'chol echad kozo v'od. In other words, now they're going to bring certain sources, not to go into the depths of each one here, about sometimes I had a source that shows that I don't have everybody with their own Kiddush cup, and sometimes I do have a source that everybody has his or her own cup. And what do I do? I ultimately get to a bottom line mihu, or a conclusion in the Tosafot, which is six lines down, about five words in, umihu begamara mashma. And nevertheless, in the Talmud, it says, shetzarich kol echad arba kosot, that each individual needs four cups. Diketani, as it's taught, hakol chayavin ba'arba kosot, everyone's required to have four cups, echad nashim ve'echad tinokot, whether it's women or whether it, in this case, the youth, Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Mato elit latinokot b'yayin. What is the deal here with youth having wine? Dilatana comment, Sarich Kos, Af Latino Kot. The Yeshli Chot, the Chayavin Lishmoa, Birkat, Arba'a Kosot. Okay, so maybe the youth don't have to drink real heavy-duty wine that's going to intoxicate them. Maybe they just, what they're saying is, if the kid is of age to be educated, you have four cups in front of him, and the important part is that you actually say the blessings. Mishum Chinuch. V'nirei l'hachamir, ulahatzrich arba kosot l'chol echad. And so here's how it comes down, that you have to be machmir, you have to be ultimately stringent in your approach, or strict in your approach, l'chol echad, that there should be four cups for everyone. And here we have everyone equaling who? Women and youth. Sarich lizahir. And so, when we thought about the Mishnah before, and we read it as everyone in town who might have some problem funding his or her own meals for the week and had to receive charity funds from the tamchui, from the soup kitchen, and now the soup kitchen has to go the extra effort to make sure, maybe what it means is that everybody in his or her own household, in addition to whomever is obviously impoverished, has to really make sure they've got enough for everybody to have four cups for everybody in their household. And even though it's embarrassing to take money from the public funds or wine from the public that was purchased to make sure everybody had it, says one source, you've got to make sure you do it. And this is really the way to accomplish it. Now, that builds on the notion of our focus before, over the last couple shiurim, that we said the impoverished folks for Pesach, we had to make sure that they were covered. It means that everybody in his or her own household is covered. And by the way, the Tosafot in Ashkenaz add the dimensions of, yes, women are participating, and yes, Tinokot are participating their way, and be sure to set up the Seder table right.
during this discussion, they talking specifically about wine? When did grape juice and other things come along?
That's a really good question, and we're going to hold off because we're going to look at a tshuva about it later on in the semester. So, may one make kiddush on grape juice? May one use grape juice for the 4 cups of wine at Seder? And we're going to look at it, and the answer in short is yes. And there are some debates, and we'll look at some of the reasoning behind the debates.
Because the whole discussion is about the poor and wine. Wine's more expensive than grape juice, so they were insisting that people would have wine at the time rather than grape juice?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing about grape juice. I can't remember when it was. I think it was when we studied Shabbat, the 16th chapter. So if you imagine this, we who take grape juice for granted, it's a very recent invention. To actually have real grape juice that doesn't either ferment or become vinegar is a really new invention. So the fact that it came on the scene, Halacha has had to deal with the question, and now we have it. And I would say mitzvah mina muvchar, way to really do it nicely is to use grape juice from Eretz Yisrael, right? Just fantastic grape juice from Eretz Yisrael. Bobby, and then Ron.
Yeah, so two things. One is that I think we talked about the ancient wine being diluted. It had a type of concentrate, and then they diluted it. So I think for children, they could dilute it more than for adults. It might be the kind of
nice
wine.
Nice, if we want them to really drink.
Yeah, the other thing is, though, we see now that you should have it, but there's no explanation of why it's so important to have it. All they say is that everybody must have it, but
yeah,
it's obviously a choice, and there's no reason as to why.
Oh, I think that they're assuming, at least accepting, the ta'am of Rashbam from Bereishit Rabba.
Which was?
4 languages of redemption, and that it really brings you through the languages of redemption.
That, meaning that everyone, though.
Yes, and everyone was included.
Right.
And that the Meiri, as we read in the Steinsaltz in the 14th century, around the same time as the Tosfot, is circulating the idea that might have been his own, might have been more widely accepted, that there are 4 levels of redemption, and that there are different ways that these languages are understood in that vein, and that when you get to the different blessings during the Haggadah or during the Seder night, you really have this kind of narrative unfolding.
The mitzvah of matzah is from the Torah.
Right.
The mitzvah of arba kosot, it's not from the Torah.
That's why in the Mishnah, it's so prominent at the beginning of this chapter.
So, whose idea was to invent the 4 kosot spread over the whole story?
Well,
I see different connection. I see that maybe they did it so to have people, because wine was something of joy, to spread it around the 4 hours so everyone will wait to the end of it and not to do, and all the other is just nice poetic translation.
Yeah, so one of the ritual studies questions in this chapter, right, is why wine? You're on to it, gotta be. We know though from Proverbs already, yain yismach levadam, wine gladdens the heart. Are we sure that it was just a rabbinic invention or convention to use wine for kiddush and arba kosot? Not sure how widespread or not it was, but we have reportage from the time that, you know, we've kind of seen through history that is the accepted practice, and it's codified here in the Mishnah.
Because the story that you studied last week, which is 2 rabbi and 1 maybe that will show up, there was missed to be much earlier, and the only thing that they have to do is to put a white map and to have a matzah.
Right, to cover.
To cover. That was the whole Seder, and they did it much earlier.
Well, it's not the whole Seder. We're not through the Mishnahs yet. We didn't read the whole paragraph.
In the story.
In the story, except that they're starting the Seder experience that is at least in the Mishnayot that we're about to read.
Oh, that is continuation
yes.
of that story.
The continuation of what you would think is, oh, that looks and feels and sounds like the Seder that I know. Yeah, it's not just the matzah. We were concentrating on the mitzvah of matzah the last time around because we were wondering whether or not anything could be eaten that either looked like matzah, felt like matzah, was made from matzah. You know, and the quick answer to that, I don't know if I was succinct enough or clear enough, is no. The foods that one could eat beforehand were generally defined as fruits. That's the most widespread understanding of what one could eat if one held the position that you could eat before the Seder, or small meats. I did not run across anybody who said that you should eat eggs. Not sure if they ate...
But not the meat of the mincha.
No, no, no. We're not talking about temple. We're talking about eating in private domiciles.
So fruit or small meats.
I don't know. This might be really weird. But I'm sure in the Sfatim, eventually, they have to deal with what if you can't get wine for your Seder, and... What do you do, or is that not?
So interesting question, right? Let's hold that. Because they deal with questions of other substances that we can use for Kiddush, my question for us is going to be whether or not they're actually asking the question you're asking. And whether or not some of these would apply in such a way as to be acceptable. Right? Obviously, if they're chametz, it's not going to be okay. But how about some of the other drinks around? Can I use something different for my arba kosa?
Vodka from potatoes.
Yeah, any of these things. And I think that the questions are going to come through some of the other questions we're going to experience. All right, let's go to a different part of the Gemara now. Back to 100b1. And this gets into this question about Kiddush. Again, jumping off the notion that we're talked about four cups and that there's meaning to cups of wine, and that wine with regard to Kiddush was discussed about when I have to stop and make Kiddush if the nighttime comes. I'm now, since I'm talking about Kiddush and I'm talking about wine, I'm now going to see that the Gemara is going to bring up a dispute regarding Kiddush recited by the Chazan in the Beit Knesset. Kiddush recited by the leader of the prayers in the shul. Okay?
Shabbat Kiddush.
Really, it's the one at night that we're talking about. Yes. So Shabbat Kiddush, but the one in the service versus the one that we make it Kiddush.
Right.
Not the Kiddush at Kiddush, but the Kiddush before Aleinu. Okay. Otam b'nei Adam shekid shu b'beit ha-knesset, regarding those people who made Kiddush in the shul. Okay. Amar Rav. Rav says the following. I'm on 100b2 now. Yidei yayin lo yatsu. They have not fulfilled their obligation to recite a blessing over the wine that they'll drink at home. Yidei kiddush yatsu, but they have discharged the obligation of saying Kiddush. Shmuel amar, but Shmuel says, af yidei kiddush lo yatsu. No, they didn't fulfill their obligation to say Kiddush, nor did they say their obligatory wine blessings, because they're going to drink wine. So, again, Rav, they have not fulfilled the obligation to recite a blessing over the wine, but they did fulfill the obligation for Kiddush. That means I could go home, and what? If I'm going to drink wine, what do? Brei Bria Gafin, and that's it. I don't then have the whole paragraph of Kiddush to say it. I heard it in shul. Shmuel says, no, you haven't done either. You got to bless your wine, and you got to say Kiddush. But according to Rav, why does he need to recite Kiddush in his home? The Gemara answers. Now, this assumes, by the way, that Rav holds that he's got to recite Kiddush at home, even though he has fulfilled the obligation. Ah! So Rav, who knows that the practice is that people come home and say Kiddush anyway, even though we just said it sounded like he could just come home and make a Brei Pri HaGafen and drink, Kedei Lehotzi Banav Uvenei Veito, was because he had to come home and make Kiddush and fulfill or exempt, or how are we going to translate Lehotzi to make it exact here? If I motzi acherim, I fulfill their obligation. I'm not sure it's the best translation. It's really not, right? So I'm looking for...
To execute the mitzvah for the others.
To execute the mitzvah for the others. That's a possibility.
That lotzi mechova.
Right. To... Yeah. There's another way to say it, to exempt them from doing it themselves. In other words,
it's not exempt, then they need to do it.
Yeah, it's making them yotzi, which is why my exempt word is not the proper word.
No.
Right.
It's the right concept, but it's just not how we say it in English.
Right. How do we say it in English in the best way? To say it again?
Execute. What I said is to have them hear the kids.
Let's
say
it
means something like to execute something.
To execute the mitzvah so they can hear it.
Right, it is in both in the sense to provide the performance, and it is to help you fulfill your obligation.
But I'm surprised that they didn't go to shul. That's what bothers me. Why they didn't come to shul.
Why they didn't come to shul. Obviously, this is a culture where they're not coming to shul.
Yeah.
Right, the children. And B'nai Beito could be
his wife,
his daughters as well. Okay, so...
Well, that also presumes that there is an obligation on children.
Correct. Correct. So, there's an obligation here. He comes home and makes them yotzi. This is the way that in the Beit Midrash, Hebrew is going to mesh. Hebrew and halachic terminology is going to mesh with English. Hu motzi otam. He makes them yotzi. He ultimately fulfills an obligation for them, or is their agent to do the mitzvah. Okay? And the bottom line is that this explains why Rav can allow for the practice of coming home and saying Kiddush to persist. Because he's got a job to do. He acts as the agent for the people of his household, the member of his household, his family, and anyone at that meal.
Wasn't Rav the one that said that you don't have to do the Kiddush again when you get home, but only...
He said that... Ultimately, listen what he said. Rav says they have not discharged their obligation to bless over the wine, but they did fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush. So the question would be then, even though we thought he meant you can go home and just say Brei Pri HaGafen and drink, Rav, if you hold that way, why does this guy go home and still say the whole big paragraph? Asher kishon mitzvah v'savanu v'shabbat kodesho v'yahaval v'ratonim chilanu, because he has others in his household to fulfill the mitzvah for.
So if this wasn't the culture that this was happening, but nowadays it is. So if your kids and your wife are with you, children, you do it there, then you go home, and it's just those same people. Is it about to want to repeat it? Because we...
It's not. And the reason's going to be, the Gemara is going to tell you in a page or two, that we have another principle that comes into play. Okay, the foreshadowing is, there's another principle, hold on. Here, the Gemara answers, though. Kedei lehotzi banav v'nei veito, so to discharge the members of the household, Shmuel lamali l'kadeshe b'vei k'nishta. But if Shmuel, who says, you're obviously going to go home and say Brei Pri HaGafen, and you're going to make Kiddush at your house, and that's the most important, because you've got your family members there, and you need to help everybody fulfill their obligation, why should I say Kiddush at all in the synagogue? What's the story? Well, la'apuke orchim yidei chovatan, of course. That is, to fulfill, to help wayfarers fulfill their obligation.
But they will go home and they will do the same.
Ah, but so they... But here's the thing. Here's the thing.
This is like a road.
The Gemara explains V'achlu v'shatu v'ganu b'veichanishta. They ate and drank and slept in the shul. So this is the concept here, that the synagogue space in any given...
was an hotel.
It was a pundak. It was a little bit of an inn.
A shelter.
It was a shelter. And the shelter is where they're going to have their meal. And so, now I get the real foreshadowing of a principle that's going to come to answer Jay's question. Since they're having a meal in this place, in the synagogue.
If they have the meal, they can have it at the table at the meal.
So for what reason do I not have them say Kiddush at the table versus my Kiddush over here at the shul's pulpit?
Right.
What might I have to consider?
Embarrass them? I don't know.
Maybe there's no one there who knows it, and that's a nice first thought, really generous first thought, versus a very technical halachic reason. What might the technical reason be? Maybe everyone's going to want to make his or her own kiddush, but I only have one cup. Maybe, like you said, wine was expensive. And I don't have enough for everybody. On Pesach, of course, the Mishnah told me that everybody's got to have his or her own cup. And the Tosafot affirmed that. But maybe over here, I can't sustain that. It would be unsustainable. Though it's an ideal in terms of the values that came out at the beginning of the Mishnah and the beginning of the Perek, the beginning of the chapter, I might not be able to sustain that through the entirety of my year. I want to keep my shul open and I want to have people sleep here. I'm willing to have food made to provide a meal. On this issue of Kiddush, I'm not giving everyone his or her own cup to make individual Kiddush.
Is it possible they don't know how to do
it? It is possible. I think your first answer was generous and it was probably right on. Some people probably didn't know how. Definitely. So, you see, below it says, the Gemara does not mean that the wayfarers ate and drink in the synagogue itself, for generally eating is forbidden in a synagogue. We have that tradition from Megillah, from the Sechem Megillah. Rather, the Gemara is referring to a room adjacent to the synagogue, and there is where they slept, and there is where they ate, and they made this meal. Tosafos discussed whether the wayfarers may listen to the Kiddush in the synagogue and then go to the adjacent room to eat, or whether they must go to the adjacent room first and listen to the Chazan's recitation of the Kiddush from there. Meaning, why can't or shouldn't they have Kiddush in the place where they're eating? B'makom ha-se'uda. And regarding the recital of Kiddush in the synagogue nowadays, we have to look at Section 269 of the Shulchan Aruch, and we're going to go over and look at it. Who knows whether it's tonight or the next time. Okay, so let's just go back inside the Gemara, though. I now understand why Shmuel is having them make Kiddush in the synagogue, and I understand why Rav is having people make Kiddush in their homes. Here is the principle. The Amar Shmuel, Ein Kiddush Ela Bimkom Suda. That the reason why you have to have Kiddush in that synagogue is because the wayfarers are eating there, and you have Kiddush in your space or place where the meal is about to be.
Why did he eliminate the Kiddush at the end of the prayer?
It's an interesting question, because it's what Jay asked. What if Leslie and his daughters come to shul? And you're there, and we're all there, and there's nobody staying for dinner in the shul. Like, even if that's the way we did Kiddush when we have a dinner in the shul. And by the way, we'll go downstairs and make another Kiddush. So don't worry. It even piles on to the question, why are we still making Kiddush in the service? Okay? Hold that thought. And let's see if we get an answer in the study. Why are we even still making that Kiddush? Ein Kiddush Ela B'Makom Suda. The Gemara ultimately is going to keep going with Shmuel's thinking. Savor Mina. The students of the academy assume that Hane Mili Mi Bayit Levayit. That Shmuel's ruling that Kiddush is invalid unless it's recited in the place where the meal is eaten apply only from one house to another house. Aval b'makom l'makom b'chad beita lo. But from one room to another room in the same house, no problem. I can make kiddush all standing around over here, and then I can move everybody into my dining room, and I can make my suda. I can have my meal. Amar lehu Rav Anan bar Tachalifa. Rav Anan bar Tachalifa says, however, zim nin sagiin havaka im nakam ed Shmuel. Many times I would stand in attendance before Shmuel. I would be there with Shmuel. V'nachit me'igra la'arav hadar mekadesh, and he would go down from the roof to the ground floor where he'd be eating the meal and only then recite the Kiddush. He wouldn't recite the Kiddush on the roof and then eat the meal on the ground floor of the house. Thus we see what? Reciting Kiddush and eating the meal in two different parts of the house, one cannot fulfill the requirement that Kiddush must be recited in the place where the meal is eaten. Which is again why the Tosafot wanted to know, according to our footnote, what do they have to do? Can they sit where the Chazan is davening Mariv for Shabbat, where I have services going on for the evening service of Shabbat, and saying Kiddush there? Do they have to, or do they have to get up and go into the little room that's attached in the shul, if they're eating in the shul, these wayfarers, and hear the Chazan make Kiddush while they're in that room?
They're all under the same roof.
Correct.
All under the same. You know what I'm thinking of? Because I know of what this rabbi was in class, but that when you move from one space to another, so say we're in the restaurant and Kiddush was said over the coffee, the blessing was said over the coffee, and left the coffee shop and took that cup of coffee into another space, and would have to say the blessing all over again, because you're moving from one space to another, carrying it out into a public space.
Right.
So this is what it sounds like.
Nice. Like with regular laws of blessing, some people would hold that in fact you just carried it through the public thoroughfare into a new space, and then in that space you wanted to say a blessing, you could bless it again. There are those who hold that if you took a sip of it while you were walking, though, you didn't have to.
No, as long as you leave one space and taking it.
That's what I'm saying. It depends on if you kept drinking it. The Af Rav Huna Savar, and Rav Huna says, here's what he says, Ein Kiddush Ela B'Makom Suda. He agrees there's no Kiddush, in other words, one must make Kiddush in the place where one is eating. The Rav Huna Kaddish, what's that? Someone say something? Oh, sorry. The Rav Huna, I must have heard Rav Huna. The Rav Huna Kaddish, that once Rav Huna was reciting Kiddush, the Itakrale Shraga, but his lamp fell, extinguished before him, right? How does a lamp fall and extinguish?
Candle.
Right. It's probably an oil lamp. It's probably an oil lamp, and there's some amount of oil in it with a wick, and it falls over and it spills. Versus candle, but all right, so a candle also existed. V'ayolele lemane leve ganene del rabba bere. They brought his utensils to the little chuppah house of his son Rabba. In other words, he was celebrating having been married, and these sheva brachot, and they make these small spaces where people come and celebrate meals. New faces would come to each of the meals 7 days after a wedding to make what's called sheva brachot, to add a dimension to saying the birkat hamazon, the blessings after you eat. You want to add the seven blessings you said under the chuppah, so they made such a structure that's kind of like a little place that reminds you that you just got married and you had a chuppah, and they come and they make the seven blessings in such a space. And Dehava Shiraga, and there was a lamp burning, the Kaddish V'Ta'imidi. And he recited Kiddush again, and only then ate. Proving what? He had to make Kiddush in the place where he was. And that's exactly the law, Brenda, you're bringing up. Okay? He ultimately says Kiddush in the second place. Alama Kasavar Ein Kiddush Elu B'Makom Suda. And we see from this that Rav Huna really holds that with Kiddush, it's invalid unless it's in a place where you're actually going to eat the meal. Another concurring opinion, Va'af Rabba Savar Ein Kiddush Ela B'Makom Suda. And even Rabba also said that you have to say Kiddush in the place where you're going to eat, the Amar Abaye. Abaye said. I'm on 101A2 now. Ki havena beimar. When I was a student by Mar, ki hava mekadesh. He would recite Kiddush. Amar lan. He would say this to us. Ti'im umidi. Go ahead and eat something. Dilma ad azlitu leushpiza. Perhaps by the time you go to your lodgings, mit akra lechushraga, your lamp will have become extinguished. V'lo mekadesh lechubaveid achila, and you'll not make kiddush in the house where you generally eat. Uvekidush dehachalo nafkitu, and with the kiddush that you heard here, you've not fulfilled your obligation. De'ein kiddush ele b'mekom suda. So if you plan to go back to your spaces, you better have light, right? And you better be able to say kiddush and do your eating in the same place. The Gemara asks, Aini, really? Is that so? V'hamar Abaye, but didn't Abaye say the following? Kol mile demar hava avid kedarav, in all of the masters' fairs, he acted in accordance with the Rav, levar mahane talad avid kishmuel, with the exception of these three cases, where he acted in accordance with Shmuel. Matir remi beged leveged, he conceded that we may untie tzitzit from an old garment and put them on a new garment. Umadlikin miner lener, and kindle one Hanukkah light to another Hanukkah light. Oh, by the way, right? What do you not need there? A Shabbos, right? Interesting as it goes. The halacha Rabbi Shimon begrida, and the halacha follows Rabbi Shimon in the matter of dragging furniture on the Sabbath where it may create a furrow in the ground. Right? Don't drag your chairs, or else you'll be planting. Right? Well, it'll right. We might think of writing on our floors. They thought of in the earth, digging where seeds could be put down in order to create a row for your garden. The Tanya, as it was found in Brita, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, Gorer Adam Mitzah Kisei Saf Sal B'Shabbat. A person may drag a bed, chair, or bench across the ground on the Sabbath. Uvil Vad Shelo Yitkavein Lasot Charit. As long as he does not intend to make the furrow. In other words, You could actually do some of that dragging, as long as your intention was not to plant and make a furrow and, quote-unquote, break a malacha, break one of the Sabbath, one of the 39 categories of Sabbath law, which is making of this furrow. Gemara answers, Kechumrei d'Rav hava avid. Rava acted in accordance with all the stringent rules of Rav that were in opposition to the lenient rulings of Shmuel. Kikule de Rav lo hava avid. But he did not necessarily act in accordance with the lenient rulings of Rav that were in opposition to the stringent rulings of Shmuel. Thus, Abaye's statement that Rava generally followed the opinion of Rav in his disputes with Shmuel was only referring to those disputes where Rav ruled stringently and Shmuel ruled leniently. It is not referring to disputes such as their dispute regarding Kiddush in the place of the meal. That wasn't brought up here, where Rav rules leniently and Shmuel rules stringently. Meaning, it's okay to go by such a rule that comes to say you need Kiddush in a place where you eat. And just as a matter of passing interest here, so Shmuel when he says you can unfasten tzitzit from an old garment, transfer to a new garment, right? That's obviously a question, because if a garment becomes torn, it's stained, it's no longer appropriate. The question is, do tzitziot on them, the tassels that you had to tie, and these unique tzitziot from Torah law, do they become pasul as well? Do they become unusable? The answer is no, according to Shmuel. You should use them. And then from the Hanukkah light, at this point in the development of law during this age, some people might think, because of the way Chanukiyot were created, that you absolutely need this extra helper candle. But here he's saying, when you do the lighting, even though you don't have reshut lehishtamesh behem, even though you don't have permission to use them according to Jewish law, but for any work that you're going to do in your household, here he's saying, at least for the lighting, you should pick it up and feel free to use it. Right?
Is it possible
Well, it's possible to make Kiddush without then going to eat a meal, because Kiddush is a separate mitzvah from a Sudat Shabbat.
Linking it with the place of the meal and
right,
the meal.
But in general, right, that's so that the point is, but in general, you're going to have your Shabbos meal right after you make Kiddush.
Right. But if there is a situation where you're not having a Shabbos meal, you can still make Kiddush and not have a Shabbos meal afterwards.
Yeah, but I mean, it assumes very much so that in the culture, that a person's at synagogue and a person goes home and doesn't tarry and goes to make Kiddush and eat.
So if you can't eat for a medical reason, are you upset or not? Having made Kiddush? Because this is implying that it doesn't even count unless you have...
If for a medical reason you cannot drink wine, you have no obligation to drink wine.
No. I'm saying it for... I shouldn't use medical reason, because that's... Okay.
So what do you mean?
If for a reason, let's just say the sake of reason, mm-hmm. you're not going to eat, but you say Kiddush, the text here is implying that you don't get the benefit of being considered having fulfilled that mitzvah unless it's in the place you're going to eat. If you have good, valid reason to not eat, it's not a an ethical reason.
Mm-hmm.
You have
okay.
But you say Kiddush, are you? You don't say Kiddush. Or you don't get the benefit.
Yeah, you're Yotze.
Okay.
You're Yotze. You've done your obligation if you say Kiddush, but you don't eat. Yeah, it's not... The Suda... The eating of a suda, is it causative? In other words, does the suda cause the mitzvah to be fulfilled?
Yes.
With the principle, there's no kiddush except in a place where you're going to eat. In other words, you have to make kiddush in the place where you're going to eat. It's not...
You can make a kiddush any place if you want to eat or not, but if you are going to eat, make a kiddush before.
Correct.
Okay, right. That's a good rule.
Right. I think this is the true meaning of the word apodictic, right? That it's codified in such a way that it sounds like one must eat a meal in order for that mitzvah to take hold.
But
it's not causative.
Right.
It's simply codific. In other words, one may say, who has the obligation to say Kiddush must make Kiddush, and if one's to fulfill the obligation of eating a Sabbath meal and making Kiddush together, it should be in the same place. Okay. Just want to find one item here. Okay. About lighting one candle to another. So, ultimately, about the lighting of subsequent Hanukkah lights from a previously lit candle, the subject is of debate by Amoraim in the Gemara. There are some arguments. Shmuel is of the opinion that one may do so. Rav, however, requires that one maintain a separate light which does not have the Kedusha of a Hanukkah light. And therefore, that's why you get this.
Rav
says you need a shamash.
So is he more stringent in this case?
So in this case, right, if I need to maintain a separate light, I'm more stringent. Two possible reasons offered to explain the opinion of Rav. One is due to what's called bizui mitzvah, lack of respect for a mitzvah. The candle is a mitzvah candle for the Hanukkah festival, and therefore can't use it as some kind of servant light. Lighting one Hanukkah light from another would require transferring the flame from the Ner Mitzvah, from a mitzvah candle, with a splinter of wood or similar object. Since this object is not part of the mitzvah, using it to take the flame demonstrates a lack of respect for the mitzvah. This is how the thinking goes in the Gemara. The second explanation proposed is that of Achushei Mitzvah, the diminishing of the mitzvah. Through the process of transferring the flame, some of the oil of the first light is lost. Moreover, it appears as if some of the light of the Ner Mitzvah, the mitzvah candle, is being removed. Okay, the appearance one is not so... That's just appearance, but can I take away from the actual fuel of my light that I determine is the mitzvah light? That's the question.
It's interesting that they are connecting the fuel to the flame. Because you transfer a flame that already exists. Ner le'echad, ner le'me'a, so it shouldn't be a problem.
It's just a way of, I think, really dealing with the question of, are you making this a worker candle? And is there, can you, should you make a distinction if this is a mitzvah candle or not? That it can't light another one.
But, let's say you run out and you have one, two, three candles. Huh? And you don't need the shamash. So, good to know in a pinch.
Good to know in a pinch. If you want to go with Shmuel's.
So for Hanukkah, you really need to light the shamash or any candle from brand new fire, not to take from any other.
From a shamash. That's the way we come down.
You need to light the shamash with some. Can you light the shamash from another fire?
If you have other fire.
No, I'm trying to.
You shouldn't use somebody else's menorah. You shouldn't use someone else's Hanukkah.
I have it at home, I have fire. And now it's Hanukkah. Which.
Yeah, I can
fire
light my shamash.
Can I use to light the shamash?
As long as it's not one burning for Avodah Zarah, for idol worship, I think you're okay.
Well, Ron, how else could you? Yeah. I mean, it has to be somebody.
Honestly.
No, because I want to know if I need to light the shamash with brand new falter, so to speak, rather than take an existing.
You can take existing.
Is Rava always, is it important, is he always conservative? Is it important?
No.
That he's
no. So it's just certain times. Certain times they
so
kind
here
of.
Here they're pointing out that he's really going with the conservative, the stricter view.
Yeah.
No matter who. He tends to be more liberal.
It seems like where
liberal and
it was referring to those disputes where Rav ruled stringently and Shmuel ruled leniently, meaning when I compare these two and their rulings.
Yeah, but then he goes later and he says he still. I mean, there's an implication that he's usually more. The rabbi is stricter.
Yeah, I mean,
justice sticks with this. Yeah, he's a conservative judge, justice.
I would have to look through more than I'm recalling now to say, blanket-wise.
Is it important to them that they're consistent in that way, or do they not?
Well, internally, you see that the Gemara is interested in when an authority is generally respected for his opinion, or what they might use that as a reason to reject, like, oh, I hold by him when he's stringent, but I reject his leniencies. In this case, that's
what
happened.
Right. So is it important that you stay, you're consistent from place to place in the Gemara?
For some
important?
Rabbis, and for the way that Gemara legal work goes, you do have very many authorities.